Welcome to another edition of After the Buzzer. We're hanging out in the man cave. It's Mike Gross and it's Gordy Jones. Gordy, how you doing, my man?
Outstanding.
Our guest tonight is a little bit different than our normal routine. This is our guest tonight implies something that doesn't seem plausible to me, which is A, that journalism still exists, and B, that young people want to do it.
Who knew?
She is Lori Schantz. And after 25, we know her from back in the day at Penn State.
We do.
And she's been a reporter and editor all over the country. Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, Miami Herald, St. Louis Post-Dispatch. And now, of all things, a professor of journalism and communications at the University of Oregon. Lori, welcome to After the Buzzer.
Nice to be here. Thank you both for inviting me.
Let's start with this, with your kids, with your students. When they're looking at a career in journalism, they're looking at something much different than Gordy and I were looking at that age when we were thinking about a career in journalism. So what's the difference? What do they see going forward? What's going to be available for them?
Yeah, well, that's a big question to start with, which you know. So it's complicated, right? A lot of them like to write, which is good, right?
Yeah.
And they've been told somewhere along the line they're a good writer, and they might not fit anywhere else, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so they come here because they aren't really sure where they belong. They like to write. They think this is interesting. Journalists write. And a lot of what we do is say, yes, and I'm a writer. I'm a kind of a capital W writer, right?
Sure.
And on my good days. And so what we say is, it's not just writing, you know, like there's a reporting element to this and there's a social media aspect. And if you're going to go into sports, you're going to have to be able to do some radio podcasting. You're probably not going to have to do video.
Yeah.
And so a lot of it is kind of opening up their world to that. The other thing that's interesting is a lot of them want to change journalism. They're very public service minded.
Okay.
And they're not super convinced that journalism is doing things correctly.
Hmm.
I just came from I was asked to do a training for a student magazine, an independent student magazine here at the University of Oregon, Ethos. And what they wanted to hear about was trauma-informed journalism and how can I ask better questions and how can I better navigate stories with someone who's been through a trauma, whether that's, you know, out here we have wildfires, you know, COVID, you know, various identities. And they, like, I never asked these questions in college. I just went out and wrote stories.
Right.
And so this generation thinks very big picture about how does journalism fit in to a good community in a strong place in a way that, you know, I was just hanging out at the Daily Collegian with my friends and doing what I hope were good stories, but they have a much more serious public service mindset, I would say, than I did. I can't speak for you and Gordy. Maybe you two were there too, but that's different from where I was.
That's interesting.
In a good way.
That is interesting. That was a really good question on my part.
It was.
I think it was a really good answer on your part. Yeah, I didn't expect that. Yeah, that's interesting.
But you do hear that about it generationally. I mean, when people paint with a broad brush, that students of this age are sort of more geared in that direction, more thinking public service wise, and more, you know, what you know, where do I fit in the world? How can I make the world a better place? Stuff like that. So that's interesting from that standpoint, I think.
Yeah. Lori, let's
fun
talk.
To work with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I bet they would be.
Yeah,
I
right.
bet they would be.
Sure. Yeah. Lori, tell us about this sort of project that you're doing with, I mean, this is one of the, you're living in one of the centers of track and field. So were you, this thing where you have your kids covering all the events Hayward, I think?
Hayward,
is it? Yeah. Yeah,
yeah.
Tell us about that.
Yeah. So Hayward Field is, this place calls itself Tracktown USA, and
mm-hmm.
that's both just kind of a big picture, this is who we are, and there's also an actual organization called Tracktown USA that goes out and brings major meets to this place.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously Nike's interested in this, obviously the University of Oregon is interested in this, there's a lot of pieces. And the what I run is that the School of Journalism and Communication, so SOJC, so it's the SOJC Track Bureau. And I've actually based this on the last thing I did at Penn State before I left Pennsylvania, which was John Affleck, who was the Knight Chair in Sports Journalism and Society at Penn State, got this idea when Penn State played in the Croke Park Classic, oh, maybe a lot of the papers in the state aren't going to be able to send somebody, so let's take students and turn this into a bureau. And so, literally, that was the last thing I did as a Penn State employee and as a Pennsylvania resident, was I went to Dublin with this. And, you know, it ended up being James Franklin's first game. There was no Bill O'Brien, so everybody got sent. But still, we were able to publish with newspapers across the state. And when I got here, they didn't do anything like that with track. And I was like, well, this is literally on our campus. So I went around and got buy-in, and I thought at first that it would be kind of like a capstone class. Like, you would get to the end of your SOJC career, and then you would do deadline reporting, and you would cover this. And what it gradually morphed into was an entire bureau that turns out we write for newspapers and websites all over the state and even sometimes the world, because people don't have enough money to cover track and field, but they're interested in the stories. So what we do is you're truly covering a beat for 10 weeks. And it's the only place in America you can have track class. We covered 10 meets this past year. Normally we cover 6 or 7. So you start usually the first or second week of class with some meet that you don't know anybody at. You don't know anything about track and field. You don't have, I like to send people to the hammer throw and have them come back and say, Lori, those aren't hammers. I'm like, right.
Wow.
And, but it works. And it works in a way that other sports don't. And it's because you can show up every week and cover some of the same people. And you start with like the Oregon Relays or the Pepsi Invitational, the Hayward Premier. And you have people from the UO track team or from some of the community colleges or the small schools in the state who send people here. And then you gradually get up. Oh, here's the Pac-12 championships. Here's the Prefontaine Classic that has better fields than the Olympics sometimes. And then what really tipped it was the NCAA championships. The first year I taught the class in spring 2015, there was about 6 students who were really exceptionally good. And the NCAAs were at the end of class, after the end. And I said, does anybody want to cover this? Maybe we can freelance it. And I'm still a member of the Associated Press Sports Editors for my journalism career. So I put a note on the Facebook page and I said, hey, does anybody have locals? And we got a huge response.
That's great.
So that's what we do. Yeah. We cover them. Yeah. So that's what works. And it builds through the season, and they live track and field. And then with the World Championships here this past year, you know, we had some extra meets. We had some other stuff that was going on, but they had 8 students work the World Championships all day, every day. And then we rested. It was great.
I guess you would. I mean, that what was that like for them and for you? If you had 8 students there at the World Championships in July,
it was kind of wild because we'd been there when there were 15 people in the stadium and doing interviews in the dark at the bottom of the thing, and now here's the whole world, right? And you've got a desk and it just feels bigger. There's a lot of space. It's better athletes. But the really neat thing about it was that it was their home turf, right? Like, they've been in Hayward Field since the beginning of April. So they knew how it worked. They knew the sport. They had been, some of these people they've been writing about for months. And they were able to put all that together, and they really did their best work on the biggest stage.
That's great.
And this group had a real challenge because we've had 2 years of very disrupted education because of the pandemic.
Right.
So for a while, they literally couldn't do interviews. Like, it was unsafe to send students to do interviews. So students showed up for this class with less journalistic, fewer reps is what I would call it, than other students had had. And they worked really hard to get better fast. And they were just a pleasure. They were just I can't say the most fun group I'd ever worked with, because the other 7 classes would be furious. But this one will always be special because of everything we went through together. And, once you get to the international level, there's a lot of bureaucracy. There's a lot of rules that we didn't have early on. So we kind of had to learn to navigate that. And it was a really good lesson for them in how – you want to be on the biggest stage and you want to cover the big thing, but some of them were like, wow, I kind of missed the Oregon Relays when I got this whole person to talk to for half an hour by myself. So it shows them the wide variety of sports journalism you can do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I would have loved that when I was in college. Yeah, I think so, about it. Yeah,
that'd be pretty great, especially on that level when you're dealing with athletes of that caliber. That would be pretty tremendous, I would think.
And the hard part for me at the beginning was interviewing. So that would have been, yeah, really, believe it or not.
And it is hard. Right? And so one of the things that makes this class great, first of all, it puts me back in a press box where I'm not full-time anymore. And, you know, I don't want to be, I have to keep doing the work to be able to teach the work. So being in the press box with everybody else, or the press tribune, or the media tent, or the mix zone, or whatever, you know, all the various places we go matters to me a lot. Mm-hmm. And then what they're able to do is just learn a lot of different pieces of the business. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, they write on deadline. So they go to the track meet, and there's, I had 11 during the spring term and 8 over the summer, and I've had as many as 18 to 20 students in the class. And everybody writes on deadline, and nobody leaves the track until they're done. Mm-hmm. And everything gets published. So it gives them a lot of reps, and their first stories aren't great, and then we publish them anyway. The next stories are a little bit better, and the next stories are a little bit better. And so they're able to, because it's more reps than you normally get in a journalism class, the improvement comes really quickly.
How did you find the transition from reporter / editor to instructor? How did you find that to be in 2014?
I've been teaching as an adjunct at Penn State part-time for about 5.5 years. Mm. And when I did that, it was more like, here's a journalist to come in and tell us what happens in a newsroom or what happens at somewhere. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then once you get on to the faculty, you're a little bit more removed from that. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of pieces, like it's not just teaching the class. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's what surprised me the most, is that there's a lot of service work, a lot of committees. There's lots of, you know, students have a lot going on. Mm-hmm. And as you're a full-time faculty member, rather than just showing up as a guest speaker or showing up and teaching one class, you get to know them a lot better. And they show up at your office, and you get to know about their life, and you get to know about how they're trying to balance everything. And they live very complicated, difficult lives, a lot of them. Yeah. And once you see that opened up, it's a very different relationship that you have with students. I absolutely love getting to know the students and having that.
It sounds like you do. Really, that comes. We can. Yeah. We can tell. We can tell. Yeah,
that's great.
It's energizing, and it really is. Mm. And it gives me great hope for the future, because I have so many students who are so smart and so interested in making things better, and they question. Like, they are happy to question, and that's great. I try to encourage that, because I think that that's a good thing, right? And but you kind of also have to be like, well, this is how it's going to be. This is how it's going to happen. The past 2.5 years with COVID has been extremely difficult. Mm-hmm. Extremely difficult. And, you know, we can't go back, quote unquote, to normal. You know, I mean, I'm in a lot of industries that are in disruption, right? And journalism has been in disruption pretty much since I went into it. And higher ed is also in disruption. Mm-hmm. And so working at the intersection of those two, you know, what do we call them? They're challenges, right? Mm. And that you're able to have these challenges and figure out how to fix them. Mm-hmm. And it's just been really fun. I've really enjoyed it.
That's great.
Lori, we hear so much about how college campuses are enclaves of this political correctness, woke culture thing. I'm so tired of hearing about that. Is that a real thing? Of course it's a real thing to an extent. To what extent?
That right. I mean, what I see is students who genuinely want to make a difference and genuinely want to do the right thing. Mm. And sometimes I believe if you set the bar high, and if you help students feel comfortable at the beginning and let them know that they can question, and you know, I'm very clear in my syllabus, everything I write, and on the first day of class about. I'm learning from you as much as you're learning from me.
Right.
Different things. And if you set that standard, I think they need it. And I think they're genuinely very concerned about what my generation and previous generations have done to the world. I think they look at climate change and they wonder what's, you know, we have wildfires out here all the time. Just last week, you know, I couldn't swim on Monday because the air quality index was hazardous, you know, so that's a very real, it's a very real tangible thing for them. You know, Oregon is a state that literally the Constitution banned Black people from living here. And so they see these things very, you know, they notice this and they ask questions about it and they say, how do we overcome this? And, you know, I don't like to label it. I think that they have good hearts and they're smart and my job is to guide them on the path, right? Mm-hmm. And that's been a true joy. And I mean it when I say I learned from them. Mm-hmm. The other thing I do here, one of the other things I do is I co-created and I co-direct the J Schools Writing Center, mm-hmm. and we train undergraduate coaches to help other students with their writing. Mm. And it's a very, there's not a hierarchy in university writing centers. It's very much a collaboration between the directors and we call them coaches, not tutors. And that kind of relationship with students, they really respond to it. And I would say that that's the biggest difference, I think, in colleges. I didn't have that kind of relationship with my professors, mm-hmm. but, you know, my husband's kind of funny. He's like, does anybody not have your cell phone? you know, and I'm like, you know, there's a few who don't have it possibly, but it's a much closer relationship with faculty than there was when I was in school. And it's an enjoyable relationship. It can be exhausting. I needed my time off, but it's mm-hmm. also really, it's really valuable, I think.
That's great.
I don't know if that answered your question at all, Mike.
You answered the hell out of that question. I'm encouraged. I'm encouraged by what I'm hearing here tonight.
I am too. Yeah. I read on your website, Lori, that you said, I don't teach objectivity per se. I teach students to be fair. I thought that was kind of an interesting. I wonder if you could expand on that theme.
Yeah. I spend a lot of time. I'm building a class right now called Journalism and Democracy that's going to be kind of a, mm-hmm. A preparatory class before you get into the craft. Mm-hmm. And, you know, is anybody really objective? Like, what does that actually mean? Mm-hmm. And, yeah. you know, when we have examples of, you know, a Black reporter at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette being pulled off of covering Black Lives Matter, that makes mm-hmm. no sense. And I have a piece that I give them early on in the term in which one of the really key parts about it is what's been perceived in the past as expertise and what's in the past has been perceived as bias. And that's a really interesting way of looking at things, mm-hmm. right? So if you see things that are happening in the media now, well, this female reporter from the Washington Post has been sexually assaulted, so she can't cover sexual assault courses. What? Like, mm-hmm. so if I have a pilot's license and I can't cover pilotry, if I've been, you know yeah. what I mean? Like, what is sure. what is yeah. that about? Mm-hmm. And so once you start to look at it, I think you can have a process by which you get as close to the truth as you can get. You know, one of the things that students are worried about, you know, I was taught that it was a conflict of interest, right? So I would never, when I was in Pennsylvania, I was a lector at my church, mm-hmm. and sometimes they would ask me to help with a newsletter or ask me to help with something, and I would say, well, no, I'm a journalist, I can't do that. Mm-hmm. That's not what I do. I have to be removed. I'm an observer, mm-hmm. and so I yeah. would pick volunteer gigs that would specifically not use my journalistic toolbox at them. Like, I felt, you know, you have to keep a line between mm-hmm. this and that, mm-hmm. and so, you know, am I being objective or not objective? Well, I don't know. And so that's what we talk about. We spend a lot of time thinking about what assumptions do we make mm-hmm. and whose word do we take as truth and whose word do we question. And once you start to pull that apart and you see who's missing from newsrooms, and it's young people, it's Black people, it's brown people, it's Native people, mm-hmm. it's women, mm-hmm. and it's especially, you start to wonder, well, wait, what are we doing, you know, systemically, what are we doing that's keeping people out of the newsroom? And so I have a whole pile of readings that, you know, we look through and we say, well, how can we build this? What is the process by which we need to do this work so that we benefit? Mm-hmm. And I just feel like objectivity is like, well, if you have any opinions, you can't do this, or if this has happened to you, you can't do this. And I think that if you look at it, there is a, there are marginalized groups who have not been included and have been assumed that they couldn't cover things because they wouldn't be objective, quote unquote. Yeah, and yeah. I'm not sure that a a Black reporter who has to tell their kids what to do if they're pulled across, pulled over by a police officer for, mm-hmm. Driving while Black, I'm just not clear that, that person should absolutely be able to cover those issues. Like, if they bring something to that that doesn't, and, I see this personally from a sports standpoint, as when I'm one of the only women who was covering sports for quite a long time. I mean, I tell the story all the time that when I was at the Collegian at Penn State, I was one of two women who were routinely in the press box covering the football team. And when I went back in 2009, after a circle around the country, we ended up back in State College, and I went back in the press box as a freelancer, I was still one of two or three women. Mm-hmm. Like, what? Like, I never expected that would happen. Like, it just never occurred to me. So I think when we look at the systemic challenges to having a more accurate journalism, mm-hmm. which is how I frame it, that we want more accurate journalism, so we meet in more diverse and more inclusive newsrooms, and that's where I look. Mm-hmm. And that's a rambling answer to a really important question.
we can ramble a little bit. Really, you get the rambling clearance. it's interesting because it had never really occurred to me before to think that, well, somebody's experience disqualifies them from covering a story that's related to that experience.
Makes no sense.
That mm-hmm. had never really occurred to me before. That happens all the time, you're saying, it sounds like.
Yeah. And, students are concerned about that, right? They're like, well, I'd like to be a journalist, but, I also don't want to have to, I have opinions. I'm like, well, everybody has opinions.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think the way it's interpreted as that you're like, if you're objectivity, that you're some sort of neutral arbiter. And you're not. We make choices. Who am I going to interview?
That's
which
true.
Quote's going to be the first quote in the story?
Right, right.
Which is going to be the lead? Mm-hmm. If I'm going to if I'm going to put this sort of stuff in there, journalists make a series of choices all the time, and I don't think we often acknowledge how much power we have because it's so natural for us to do it.
Yeah.
But once you start to pull it apart and say, why is that?
Mm-hmm.
Why is that?
Mm-hmm.
You start to wonder, well, what did I pick up here? What did I assume? And I think that's what I try to do is pull that apart and say, how can we do this better? What assumptions are we making that maybe we're missing something?
That's great.
That's interesting. I think it's also, in that vein, I think it's also possible to be so worried about being balanced, whatever that means, that you get away from the truth. You get away from, we just want to tell the truth, right? I mean, obviously that's what we want to do. It's almost a cart before the horse kind of thing, or something like that.
There's a lot, right? And I try to teach, and again, I try to think about having, it's interesting, right? Because I covered the Penn State beat for a long time. I covered the Olympic beat for a long time. I cover the track and field beat, through students here. So you're actually building relationships with people in a different way. And sometimes that's good. And sometimes, sometimes you have to look and say, well, wait, am I just assuming this person's right? Who's missing?
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I teach students to think about when they're asking questions about stories is, who's missing from this story? Whose opinion do we not have here?
Yeah.
Whose perspective is missing from this story? And
mm-hmm.
I think that asking those questions complicates things.
It does, sure. It does, yeah.
But I think that in the end it makes your work more accurate.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that a lot of times students are turned off by how fast the turnaround is.
Mm-hmm.
And they feel like they want more time because they want to be more accurate,
mm-hmm.
or because they want to be more complete.
Mm-hmm.
And so that tension, I think, is one that pushes me for
mm-hmm.
sure,
mm-hmm.
because it's a difficult, like, I teach a deadline based class, but I also understand sometimes I also do this work on, as I said, I have a very wide variety of things that I do. And one of the things I've been doing is collecting, it's my accidental dissertation, and I don't have a PhD and I don't want one, but I've spent since 2015, 2016, I've been looking at the coverage of a mass shooting down the road from us at a community college in Roseburg, Oregon, Umpqua Community College. And I have so much information about how journalists cover these kind of traumatic events that it's completely changed how I think about what I do and how I've done it. And
how so?
Students are really interested in that. It's made me realize that the first story isn't always the best story or the most accurate story, and that sometimes we're asking people to, and I've done it, asking people to react to something where they don't know what's happened yet. You know, I was just telling the one of the students who was killed in the shooting that day, I was able to spend some time with his parents, and this is very moving to me, that they had heard that something had happened at the school. They were headed out of town on a camping trip, and it was suggested to them that they not leave, and they were at home, and they got a phone call on somebody's cell from an area code 212, and they thought it must be law enforcement or something, you know, there was some national something, and it was a reporter. And they were like, how did you get this number? And I told them, I'm like, it's not hard to get your number. I could get you, I got your number really easily, but people don't understand that process. And they also didn't know anything. And it got to the point where they had so many calls that they had to, that his mom had to give up the cell phone. And because she couldn't answer them. Like, what are we doing as an industry, right? And they're very critical of how the process unfolded. No one asked them for a photo of their son, so that the photo that ran was, you know, not the photo they would have chosen necessarily. But then at the same time, it's also, they really appreciated the coverage. They never talked to a reporter because they were protected from them. And most people, they wanted to talk to them immediately before they knew anything. But they did think that the stories that were written about their son, or the way he was portrayed in these stories, was accurate and really reflected who he was as a person. But no one has ever gone back to talk to them. After, like, you know, years later, like, the neighbors formed a phalanx of lawn chairs to prevent people from getting to the house to knock on the door. And they had to do this stuff. And in the moment, everybody wanted to talk to them. And then no one has ever been back to talk to them in the 7 years since. And so it really shows in some ways how this immediate breaking news focus gives a distorted picture of what people go through and what communities who go through these tragedies go through. Anyway, that's another one of my lives, but they all kind of intersect in ways, because when it comes back to it, it's about the thing that connects everything for me is community, and sports at their best build community, and that's what connects that to the work I do in these other places. And I think sports sometimes gets underrated in the industry as, like, I'd like to think we're beyond, it's a toy department days, but there's really important work you can do there, and it really is moments when communities come to question. So at any rate, that's rambling again.
Rambling is good. Rambling is fine. You've come to a ramble zone.
Maybe we should rename the podcast. Lori, when I started out, I wanted to either be Dan Jenkins or a columnist. And I kind of got to be a columnist, but does anybody want to be a columnist? It feels like columnists are going the way of the dinosaur.
You know, it's interesting because the Register Guard here in Eugene has a fantastic tradition of sports columnists. Absolutely fantastic. And there's not been one at this newspaper since Austin Meek left for The Athletic a couple of years ago. And you know, John Canzano of the
I'm very familiar with him. Yeah, tremendous.
Yeah, who is now primarily, you know, he's on Substack now. And he left The Oregonian, and they just hired a new columnist. But it's interesting because that idea of a columnist kind of speaking for the town or the city or being part of this, the students see very little of that.
Yeah.
Like, they can, you know, the ones who have the money for it consume The Athletic. You know, because there's less of them out there, they don't see them as much. They kind of follow sports on a national scale.
Yeah.
Oregon is very interesting because it's, you know, there's one professional team in the state, and it's the Blazers, but a huge chunk of our campus is from the Bay Area, so there's lots of Golden State fans. And, you know, it's an interesting mix. But I don't know that they see that traditional sports columnist. Like, you know, I grew up reading Bob Smizek and, you know, Ron Cook and Gene Collier, and, you know, to go back, Still Music, like back in the day, and all this sort of stuff. I mean, I grew up with people who were kind of speaking for the area, and I think they see less of that. So I think what they see is like the big project kind of people, you know, like the big, like the Wright Thompsons of the world.
Oh my gosh,
like, I just have to keep telling students, look, you're not doing right level reporting. You don't even have time. Deadline is, you know, like you can't be right. You have to work your way up to right. Mm-hmm. And so what they all want to do are these big picture.
Yeah.
And a lot of them want to freelance. Like they want to cover what they're interested in as opposed to what their boss is interested in.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, that's great. But yeah, also there's a lot of things that go with freelancing that have nothing to do with doing the actual craft, you know? And so, you know, we're talking a lot about trying to prepare them more for that. When we ask our students what they want more of, they say, well, you need to teach us to freelance. And I was like, could you just, you know, I joke with them all the time. I'm like, let's just work on the stories first. Let's get a story. Let's get something that's worth it. But I see what it means. And I think they also see that the industry is difficult.
Mm.
And they, you know, they get out of here with some pretty sizable student loans. And then they look at what the pay is at some of these newspapers where you work your way up. And they're like, yeah, I don't know about that.
Yeah,
and that's valid too, right? So it's not like they want to be columnists, you know? Like
that doesn't surprise me. That's kind of how it feels to me. Yeah.
Well, I think part of it is because everybody's got opinions. Like Twitter has exploded and everybody's just throwing their opinions out there. I think that's part of it. There's no like one voice from any area
anymore.
Yeah,
that's right. What Lori was talking about. Yeah. The guy who sort of spoke for the community. Yeah, that's right.
Lori, I wonder
if it's interesting.
It is. Speaking of big projects, I think you mentioned to me that one of the things, one of the examples of you use of what not to do is a long ago LeVar Arrington story that you did. The no nut graph story.
LeVar is the gift who keeps on giving for decades later. Like,
it's amazing.
Just, I mean, it was so, he was so much fun to cover and so interesting. So I tell a story all the time of, you know, before his junior season. And, you know, we'd been, I was working for the Post Gazette. We've been covering LeVar since, you know, Mike White had probably been covering him since middle school, right? Or since eighth grade. So I felt with all this pressure to like write the definitive LeVar Arrington piece.
Right.
And I just got too much stuff. Like I had so much stuff. And then SI put him on the cover. Then that was the story about like his dad and the Vietnam War. And I was like, that was my stuff. So at any rate, I over-reported the bejesus out of the story. There's no other way to say it. And I had very good stuff, but I overwrote it to the point that there was literally no, you know, what we in the industry would call a nut graph, like your kind of statement of theme, like, you know, and this is what it is. And I have this, it's like a long piece. It's like a 70-inch piece or something like that. And it's a couple thousand words. And it's not a bad piece. Like, I'll stand behind the reporting of it and some of the writing of it. But it's really unclear what I'm doing in that piece. So what I do is, when I'm teaching how to write a nut graph or how to develop a theme for your story and about where it belongs in the story, I have this printed out, and I take my name off of it, and it's off of the thing, and I give it to my class, and I say, find a nut graph in this. What is this a story about? And they have no idea. It's about like 17 things. And then, you know, some of them who have done their homework, and some of them do, many of them do, they guess it's me, but when you take your name off of it, and then you put it out there and say, look, this published, this was a good story, but it's not good enough, and I'm using this to do that. So, yeah, I actually use that. I use that story to say, this was a really good story that would have been much better if I and an editor with time had been able to say, hey, let's shape this a little bit. Maybe you don't need 15 paragraphs to get this part, Lori. Maybe you could do it in shorter. And I was like, and it was only obvious in retrospect, but yes.
Yeah, that's right. It's only obvious in retrospect. I've done that.
Who has
certainly done that? Yeah, that's you think you're trying so hard to knock it out of the park that you get you lose sight of what am I really trying to
forest and tree. Was that the one that was there something at the beginning about like a butterfly picture or something like that?
Butterfly, yes. Oh my gosh, 40, yeah.
Very impressive.
And that's a funny story too, right? Because I tell this all the time. So I actually got to interview LeVar in person, and anyone who covers Penn State football will know that that was not necessarily a thing back in the day.
Right,
and I actually got to go to his apartment.
Right.
So I show up at his apartment, and I'm wearing sandals, and LeVar has like three pit bulls. So I'm sitting there, and there's like three pit bulls like coming up, and I'm like, if they chew my foot off, is this workman's comp? Like, what happened here exactly, right?
Good thinking.
So I'm having this long, long conversation with LeVar, and what I ended up bringing up at some point, he and Brandon Short were always talking trash about playing chess.
Right.
And I brought this up, and I was just like, so LeVar, like, you know, really? Are you really playing chess with Brandon? And he goes, you don't believe me? Come on back here. And I'm like, what? And he's like, drags me down the hall. And now I'm in his bedroom, right? And, you know, there's actually a chessboard set up in the corner, and it's clearly in the middle of the game. And I'm like, because, see, I told Dover Wright, and I don't know anything about chess. And I'm like, okay. So I was looking there. So now I'm in a spot that no reporters ever get to go, right?
Right.
So I go in there, and I start looking around, and there's all of these, like, snapshots on the wall of LeVar and, like, randos, like, with fans. And I was like, LeVar, I said, what are these photos? He's like, oh, well, you know, people come to me all the time, they want my picture. And I said, well, that's fine, but you got to send me one. And I was like, and they do that? And he's like, yeah, these are people who sent the photos to,
oh,
like,
my
sports
God.
Information.
Oh,
and
my
he
God.
Had them hanging up all over his room.
Oh, my God.
And you can see how I would have written this story differently now, right?
Right.
But they had all these photos around the room. And then the only other thing hanging on the wall is this, like, it looks like a centerfold from Ranger Rick magazine. It's like a giant double truck of a butterfly. And it's the only other thing hanging on the wall. And I was like, LeVar, why is this on your wall?
What?
And he looks at me and he goes, isn't that a beautiful blue butterfly?
Oh, God,
and I was
love
like,
him.
Yes, why, yes it is. So anyway, like I was talking about, you know, Sports Illustrated's already scooped me, and I'm feeling all this pressure to do this big story and everything else, and I'm trying to really show who this guy is, because he's really, in a lot of ways, one of the most unique people I've ever written about. And when people ask me what it was like to interview LeVar, that's what I told as the story all the time. And then finally, I was like, oh, the lead. It's the beginning, because it actually does show who he is.
Yeah, that's a good, yeah, sure.
I could have done it more artfully now, decades later, mm-hmm. or even with a little bit of time and less pressure. So again, like, I can show that story to students and say, look, I did a good job on all of these things, and I stand behind this. It got, you know, it got some attention. It was a nice piece, but here's how it would be better. And that's part of doing this work, is that it's a craft.
Mm-hmm.
And as a craft, the more you do it, the better you get. I mean, I talk about reps all the time, and I'm like, mm-hmm. reps, it's like drills at the, you know, it's like drills at the basketball practice, or mm-hmm. like I'm taking piano sure. lessons. It's like playing scales.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you just have to get reps at stuff to be good at it. And
mm-hmm.
that's an example where I wish I had that story back. Because I probably just told
we
that
all
story
have
better now than mm-hmm. I did when I wrote it.
Yeah. So how would you have done it? Would you say, oh, LeVar Arrington, man of the people, because he's with all these fans? Or how would you do it?
I think I would have put, so interestingly, I might have actually made myself a character and had my, like, how unusual his room was. I think my first draft through it, I would have written it in first person,
mm-hmm.
because I think it was the interaction and it was my reaction that was like, what are these things on the wall
mm-hmm.
and why is it there?
Yeah.
And I think the interaction mm-hmm. shows who that was. And I'm not a fan of, you know, I don't have a problem with first person in a story if it benefits the reader.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in this case, my perspective would have benefited the reader more.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe in the editing process, or once it got an outside look by another editor or my own work, that I might have taken that out. But that's the way I would have done it, would have been that sense of, you know, I tried that, but I focused on the butterfly instead of the randos in the photo.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the mm-hmm. randos in the photo mm-hmm. was the place to start. And
so
then the butterfly is the kicker, which is the way I told it here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right. That's the way you told it.
See?
Yeah.
Get me rewrite.
Yeah, right. Can I redo this? You should be able to redo stories from your career like a decade later just to be able to get, like, that actually be kind of cool. Like, there's some stuff I'd like another whack at.
Yeah,
you know?
Same.
Yeah. I sometimes do that because we have this online archive now. I sometimes look at stuff
yeah.
like to do research, and then I look at it a little bit and mess around with it, and it's, you know, it's still, I mean, nobody's going to really see it, but it's still, yeah,
it's like, it's more for yourself.
Yeah, it's more for yourself, which is fine. Yeah. Hey, Lori, we really appreciate
yes,
this.
Yes, we do.
It was great talking
yeah,
to you. I actually am more optimistic about the future of humanity now. Not to overstate it or anything.
No, not at all.
Yeah. So, I mean, I really think that's the thing, right? Is that management level, and they were cutting jobs, and everything just seemed like a struggle, right?
Yeah.
And I was like, you know, I need to go somewhere where people have hope. And where's the best place to find people with hope? Honestly, in a lot of ways, it's the college campus.
That's
and
a good point.
I feel like I feed off of that a lot, and that was a really, it was an excellent decision that I made. And while I didn't start out my career there, I'm definitely in the right place.
That's great.
Definitely the work that matters.
Well, you could just tell in your voice just how content and gratified you are by what you're doing. It's really evident in your whole bearing here, for sure.
That's very cool, because it's true, so I'm glad
it
comes across.
Yeah, so we wish you the best, and it was really great speaking with you, and hopefully we'll talk again soon.
Thanks, Lori.
Yeah, hopefully there'll be a Penn State, Oregon Rose Bowl again here or something, and then we can have a little reunion.
That's right.
You know, I can see it from all the sides.
That could happen. Thanks, Lori.
Take care.
All right, thanks, guys.
Be well. So, Mike, I thought that was really a kind of a wide-ranging conversation.
Yeah, that was great.
And really, it does seem like she's in a good place in every respect, yeah. I would say.
Yeah, I'm so surprised to hear that these kids that are her students who are in journalism are so conscious of wanting to do the right thing and wanting to make journalism better and make the culture better. I mean, am I overstating it?
In my current job, but one of the things that I often have to research is just about millennials and Generation Z, and they are more big picture, more public service oriented, more social justice oriented. That is sort of a thing that's, you know, obviously you're in danger of painting with too broad a brush, but that is a characteristic that many people see in these younger generations.
That's
that they really do care about environmental issues, they really do care about race and racial justice and so on and so forth. So I think that must be gratifying to be around.
Yeah, I think we went through a period in the culture, even after you and I, the time when you and I were coming up through the ranks, when it was almost the opposite of that.
Yes,
it was very me-oriented,
yes,
right? And I it does feel like it's changed, but I'm kind of surprised and encouraged to hear the extent to which, I mean, Lori really emphasized that.
You can just tell in her voice that she did, it's just a whole new vibe. And I was thinking while she was talking that, you know, obviously Joe Paterno's time ended in a horrible way. However, I'm convinced that one of the reasons he was there as long as he was is because of the whole youthful energy.
No doubt.
That was what kind of powered him through his long career. Now, we can talk about the end all we want, but to me, that was a big part of his longevity.
And we heard him say stuff like that, stuff that indicated that over the years that I thought was obviously genuine. I remember one time him talking about, well, what would you want to do if you couldn't coach football? And he said, well, I'd like to go to, like, Brooklyn, where I grew up, and start a school there and try to help some of these kids. Like, if you go up to, and I remember him saying this specific thing, if you go up to Brooklyn, in the neighborhood where I grew up, on a weekend, you'll see a basketball game going on at a playground, and half the guys on that basketball court could probably make Penn State's basketball team, but they couldn't get in school because nobody ever took an interest in them.
Right.
I remember that. I think that's almost an exact quote, because nobody ever took an interest in them.
It's quite a commentary. It really is. And it's, you know, there's a lot of circumstances that go into it. You know, it's like a lot of times it's an accident of birth, you know, it really is.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, well, we wanted to go, speaking of Penn State, we wanted to segue into the fact that Penn State played a great game last week at Auburn, won 41-12 and looked great doing it. Nick Singleton from Governor Mifflin had a great game.
Yep.
A lot of guys had a great game.
Yep.
And this is the question I wanted to throw to you, Mike Gross, since you were there. Where does that game rank as far as the best regular season games Penn State has played under James Franklin against an FBS opponent? That's a lot of qualifiers, I realize, but I think I have to couch it like that.
Well, I mean, I'm thinking back on a few. I remember sort of early in my time covering Penn State. Penn State had been down for a while. They were starting to come back up. They played Nebraska up there, and they really smacked the crap out of them.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be one of them. I think the time they beat Ohio State, when Ohio State had the quarterback who won the Heisman.
Troy Smith.
Yeah, when they had him. I thought that was a great performance.
That was a good one.
The Big Ten Championship game in 16 was a spectacular performance, but probably not as good on both sides of the ball for four quarters as this was, because Wisconsin really smacked them around physically early in that game, and they just made so many big explosive plays later on. To, I mean, Saeed Blacknall went nuts in that
game. Yes, he did.
Anyway.
But I think it has
to be. So it would be up there. You're right. It would be up there if you look at the whole thing on both sides of the ball and winning on the line of scrimmage. Because if this Penn State team can win on the line of scrimmage, there aren't many people, there aren't many teams they can't beat. I still think Ohio State and Michigan are ahead of them at the offensive skill positions, even as good as Penn State is. Overall, athletically, the overall roster, all the position groups, they're still ahead of them. But everybody else in their roster, I would say that's not true of, honestly.
So they have Central Michigan, and then they have Northwestern, and they should win both of those games. So they'll be 5-0 going to Michigan.
Going into a bye week, and then Michigan.
So so there you go. So,
it's on the road, though. It's on the road. That will be one of the big, it should be one of the biggest games in the country.
Yeah.
You know, by then they could be ranked in the top 10. If Michigan keeps taking care of business, they should be in the top 5. I mean, I think they might be 5th now or something.
I forget what they are.
They have not played. Harbaugh has normally played a pretty good non-conference schedule. Not this year.
Right.
Not this year. They got stiffs lined up outside of the league.
So, yeah, I think it's certainly. I mean, they did start 5-0 last year, though, right? So, but then they had the injury to Clifford.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, one of the many things I was thinking about watching that game was, does this change anybody's opinion of Sean Clifford, or is that strictly a week-to-week thing in the fan base?
Well, to some extent, it's a week-to-week thing, but the complaints about him, the absence of the complaints about him was kind of deafening. I mean, because it wasn't like he played the best game of his career on Saturday. I didn't think he was very good, but I thought he played better against Auburn last year.
Yeah, he did.
I think that probably was the best game I've ever seen him play was Auburn last year. He's underrated. I mean, he's underrated, and part of it is that he's made big mistakes. He's thrown some picks that have been disastrous, but he's underrated, and he's a good college quarterback. I mean, it's that simple, yeah.
Yeah, so
and because of the Will Levis transfer, they had no options when he got injured last year. This year they might.
Yeah, this year we've seen that Christian Velu, he's gotten into game to play, and we know Aller can play, it looks like.
Yes.
Yeah. So the depth shouldn't be an issue there if there is an injury. But last year, that clearly Taquan Roberson was not ready at all.
Was not ready at all, and was put into an extremely tough spot for a kid who's not ready, almost as tough as imaginable, but still. Yeah, that's a difference.
So Will Levis, speaking of him, he's being spoken of as a very high draft pick now, which is interesting to me. He's at Kentucky, for those in our listening audience who don't know, and he had a good year last year, and he's expected to have an even better year this year. So
he's almost a Tebow-like guy in terms of running, but he's gotten much more advanced in the passing game than he was when he was at Penn State.
Right.
It's easy to blame Franklin for letting him go and not picking him over Clifford and all that, but really, given the facts at that moment, that's a little unfair to Franklin, I think.
Yeah. So I mean, it's like I have no problem with the transfer portal, and a guy like Levis probably should have. You know, he gets his own team. You know, that's just the way it works. You know.
I'll give you an amazing number.
Okay.
44% of the starting quarterbacks on week one in FBS were transfers.
That's a good stat.
44%, almost half.
That's pretty great. I mean, that's pretty amazing, you know,
that it
would be that high.
Yeah.
Nonetheless, I mean, I'm in favor of this. I mean, it's just like, you know, why should you, be sitting there if you know you can play?
Why can somebody tell you you can't transfer to another college in any context?
Thank you.
As a student, I mean, why couldn't we do it? I mean, we were college students.
Yes, exactly.
You know what I'm saying.
So, but anyway, so that bears watching in the weeks ahead. And we also, as do the Philadelphia Eagles, who are now 2-0 and coming off a very impressive victory over the Vikings on Monday night. On Monday night when the Bills also played, and it would lead you to conclude that the Bills and the Eagles will be the Super Bowl matchup. Now, of course, the danger within making any supposition, speaking of week to week, I mean, health is always the biggest issue in the NFL. Yeah. Always, always, always.
And they're playing more games than the college guys are, so that multiplies it. I mean, you can't. But here's the thing in which the Eagles and Penn State are very similar. everybody said at the going into the season, well, can the offensive line figure it out for Penn State? And if it can, they're going to be pretty good. They have a chance to be pretty good. And it was a very simple thing with the Eagles, too. It was the quarterback. Is he going to figure out and go to the next level in terms of the passing execution of the passing game? And through 2 weeks, the answer to that question is as emphatic a yes as he could possibly
be. Yeah, I mean, he brings a lot to the table, the way he can move around and do some things. And he's got really good receivers, Devontae Smith and A.J. Johnson. So it's a really important – and they have some backs. I mean, Miles Sanders has had some – he had a hamstring in the preseason, but he looks like he'll up. And they might have the best offensive line in football. Yep. They very well might.
Offensive line, they have a good defensive line, and they have depth.
Yes.
So even though they're older, they can absorb an injury or two.
Yeah.
Obviously it's a long, long way to go. But it looks like at this moment, we saw the other night, the best team in the NFC and the best team in the AFC, very possibly.
Yeah, I mean, very possibly. And if you look at the Eagles' schedule, it's not difficult. It's not difficult at all. I mean, my team, the Packers, comes to play there, but I don't even know how good they are.
I don't know how good they are. We really don't. You have to caution everybody. It's 2 weeks. There's a long way to go.
But I looked at their schedule and I said, geez, I don't see many losses on that schedule. Yeah. And they're going to face Dallas at least one time without Dak Prescott. So that's their major rival in the division,
and their division
is not good.
And I don't even think Dallas is as good as they are. It's Penn State and the Eagles are similar in this. Again, as I get back to this thing I said before, in that the offensive line being okay for Penn State and the quarterback look like he's figured has allowed you to. It to become obvious how good the rest of the roster is, particularly in the Eagles' case. I think
that's true. Yeah. Well, the NFL is such a quarterback-driven league that stands to reason. But I think they look like a really. It's not out of the question to see them going 15-2.
Yeah.
Literally, isn't out of the question.
Yeah. And the other thing is, Detroit played a lot of man coverage in Week One, but the Vikings are a zone coverage team, and everybody said, "Well, Hurts can't figure that out. He hasn't been able to understand what that is and read the coverage and all that." Well, that sure wasn't a problem.
No, sure wasn't.
And maybe the Vikings were screwing up because I mean, what that long touchdown pass was, I mean, the guy was 10 yards behind the secondary, which is the reason why you play zone is to never let that happen, and it did.
And yet it did. Yes. Yeah. So the Eagles certainly they bear watching as well. And we wanted to, this is one last note, and this is something that I took on a new little gig with something called Liberty Ballers. It's a website.
Yeah, tell us about this.
This is a new
freelance gig. It is for Gordy.
It's part of my freelance empire. Liberty Ballers is a website, a Sixers-oriented website in Philadelphia, and the guy who runs it, Paul Hudrick, who has been on our podcast, by the way. So I called him up. I said, "Yeah, you have any interest in?" And he said, "Yeah, what if you can give me like a monthly thing, kind of a retrospective thing." So it gave me an excuse to call Sedale Threet in Australia.
As if you need one.
As if you need one. Yeah. But the first entry that I submitted, it ran just a couple days ago, was just about training camp and how, of course, the Sixers trained in F&M from 1978 to 1994, a real extended stretch, which was always great.
Yeah.
And unlike now with training camp, reporters could watch everything, and they let fans in to watch the scrimmage, the afternoon scrimmage, which is so great.
I remember that.
So great to see, especially the teams in that, the early part of that stretch where you had Julius Erving and Moses Malone. So anyway, the point of my column was just about Sedale Threet was a sixth-round draft pick because they had sixth-round draft picks then, and the year after the Sixers won the title. And so it's a pretty stacked roster. Is there a place for a sixth-round draft pick? So he comes in out of West Virginia Tech, and in one of the scrimmages, he decides he's going to go in and try to dunk on Moses in an open court situation. Well, he gets called for a charge, but really not the point. It's like, this guy is there's no fear here. And so I talked to Sedale. He said, "Oh, yeah, I tried to throw down on Julius, too." And he said he did this, and the ball like climbed off the rim and rolled like halfway across the gym. So he went and got it. And the way he described it was, everybody's looking at him like, are you crazy? So Sadale makes the team. He plays for the Sixers for 3+ years.
It's a good kind of crazy.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. And he ends up playing 14 years in the NBA. And, you know,
he did fine.
Very respectable career. So
I did not remember West Virginia State. I did not know that part of it. Yeah. But I knew that he was not from, he didn't go to Kentucky or Duke.
But it was evident right away that he was, you know, that he fit in, that he could play in the NBA. And ultimately he had a nice long career. So I made the point that that's kind of the timeless approach for guys on the fringe. You know, you just have to have no fear in this. I mean, granted, training camp is just a part of a much larger thing. Summer league, training camp, preseason, whatever.
Especially now.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, it's just part of it, but still, it does say something. It's not an insignificant part.
So libertyballers.com, is that the deal? And it'll be roughly once a month. Yeah, it'll be featurey type things about
retrospective
history.
Stuff.
History, yeah.
Yeah, like, Julius Erving is coming to Lancaster on Monday, so I hope to get him and I hope to use him for one of these pieces, because Glenn Robinson, as you know, was on our podcast, and he told that story about playing one on one against Julius, where he's going, "You're hanging."
What a matchup! Exactly. The classic matchup.
Exactly.
Dr. J against Glenn.
So I hope to talk to Julius at some point, either before or after his appearance on Monday here in Lancaster. So
very cool. All right, so we're getting into the fall. This is really a great time of year for sports.
Always.
It's coming, and we're going to have some good guests, including next week,
Mike
Sielski, the Philadelphia Inquirer columnist. We're going to talk about the interesting topic of sports writers who fans think must be fans too, in addition to other things.
Right, because he had a whole discussion on Twitter yesterday with fans who didn't quite grasp it.
A lot of people sincerely, they're not trying to be belligerent or smart, really don't get that. I've thought about that a lot. It'll be interesting to talk about.
I think so. And I know also Mike has had a book out for a while now about Kobe Bryant called The Rise, and I've read it, and it's exceptional. And
it's like a Kobe Bryant origin story.
Yes.
Like the Batman origin
story. Yes, and Mike really got into the weeds with a lot of people, and so we'll talk a little bit about that, and I'm sure we'll go in a lot of different directions, because we always do.
That's how we roll. All right, gang, that's it. We'll talk to you again soon. He's Gordy. I'm Mike. See ya.
See ya later.